worldwide.
Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Greg Audell. I serve on the board of directors of Writers in the Schools, where we teach kids to write their own stories. And I work with JVibe.com, where we strive to bring you the very best news going on in Houston. The master of the control room tonight is our favorite veteran, Jacob Reiner, who, as always on Thursday night at 10 p.m., is helping me devour chocolate chip cookies and ice-cold chocolate milk while he's doing the magical work in the control room that's bringing you and I together tonight. I urge you to have a favorite snack in front of you, whether it's cookies or carrots, because it is story time, my friends. On behalf of myself, Warren, Laura, and Jacob, we'd like to wish a happy birthday and hopes for a wonderful year ahead to our friend and Dr. Hank's awesome wife, Phyllis. Thanks for all you do for Hank and to help him with this show, and thank you for being a friend to each and every one of us. Now, Jake, you just returned from spring break?
Yes, I did.
Where'd you go?
I went to Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Do you have stories to tell, or are they all in the vault?
No, it was a blast. Luckily, we got out of there before the snow hit, but I miss it. I really do miss those Rockies.
Yeah, it would probably be a while before you're going to see much snow in Houston.
I'd say, what, another 15 years?
I think we're due then. You know, it's almost a universal truth that hardship and challenges hit everyone at some point in their lives. I've never known the magic quality that makes some people rise above the tough blows in life, while others simply give up and give in to them. I'm hoping that my guest tonight, Stephen Wexler, can help us get a bit closer to that answer. I've known a lot of interesting people in my life, and Stephen is high on the list of the very most interesting. In addition to a great sense of adventure, he has a little bit of education. He has a BS degree in biology from Tulane University, a medical degree from UT Medical School in San Antonio, a master's in theater from Houston's own University of St. Thomas, an MBA from Cameron School of Business at St. Thomas, and finally, well, at least finally so far up to this point, a JD from South Texas College of Law. Few people have a more thorough and diverse education, and I can't even fathom the amount of schoolwork you've completed. And am I right that now you're running the legal aid clinic at Legacy Community Health?
Right. Probably for about a year now, they asked me to start up this clinic, and I said, not a problem.
Did you ever anticipate your degrees would all meld together so nicely that
never,
way?
Never, not like this.
It's amazing. And you're a former surgeon, an entertainment lawyer, screenwriter, and tell me if I'm missing anything, a father, and a great storyteller. So tonight, he's going to share a couple of stories about his journey. So welcome to So What's Your Story, Stephen Wexler.
Hey, Greg, this is great to be up here. I remember this KPFT back in 1970 when it first started.
Oh,
so
wow.
So this is homecoming almost.
Well, and you were telling me this is like the center of the student revolution in Houston.
It was in the late 60s, correct.
Wow. I know a lot of people with varied interests, but I know very few who pursued them with the passion and dedication you have. And I mean, I'm not just saying this. It seems like you excel at absolutely everything you do, no matter how unrelated the fields might seem to each other. Because you've done and continue to do so much, I don't even know how to describe you when I mention you to people. How do you describe yourself?
I guess I would say that, number one, I'm lucky. The things that have happened to me, I'm fortunate to be alive. I was I was kicked out of every nursery school when I started, and I was actually one of the first ADHD diagnosed people kids in the United States.
Wow.
And I was actually in the first study on ADHD that was done here in Houston back in the mid late 50s. So I'm lucky to be here.
Well, when you were growing up in those years, particularly dealing with ADHD when they didn't really understand, what did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
At that time, I was just hoping to grow up.
Yeah, that's probably how it is with most kids, I think. Yeah,
especially today. But I think that I really didn't know what I was going to do, at least until I got to high school, and then things started to gel for me.
When was it that you decided to go into medicine? Was there a triggering event?
There were several triggering events. My dad's an OB-GYN doctor, so when I was growing up, he would take me to St. Luke's, and he would leave me in the library at St. Luke's Hospital while he would make rounds. So I would always, go through these books, and there was a very specific smell in this library that to this day I still remember. He got me a job as an orderly one summer in high school, and then I got to work in surgery in summer of my 11th grade, and one thing led to another.
I know I could not have handled that when I was in the 11th grade.
You got to have the stomach for it, for sure.
I'm fortunate to have heard a lot of amazing stories from you, but there are still stories that I wanted to ask you about that I've never had the chance to. So where better than live radio to hear it for the first time? And top of my list of my curiosity is about your work with famed Houston heart surgeon Dr. Michael DeBakey, a name we all know, and I think most people know what I know about him, that he was a brilliant pioneer. He fundamentally changed heart surgery. I know his ego was larger than the medical center, that he was feared, that he was respected. But honestly, I have never heard a single good thing about him personally. So I have this kind of strange picture of him. But you were actually his resident, isn't that correct?
When we do the general surgery residency at Baylor, at least back then, initially you live in the hospital when you're his resident. You live in the hospital for 3 months. You live in the hospital. You do not go home. You actually have a room, you eat at the cafeteria, and you never leave the hospital. It was one of these amazing things. It's like you don't enjoy it while you're doing it, but when it's all over with, you can look back on it and just say, wow, I can't believe I did that.
Well, I can imagine.
He would admit maybe 20 patients on a Sunday, 15 patients on a Monday, 10 patients on a Tuesday, and everybody would have had all their surgery by Friday. Of that week. DeBakey was born in Lake Charles, Louisiana. His parents were immigrants from Lebanon. He went to Tulane College. He went to medical school at Tulane, trained at Ochsner in New Orleans. And he was one of these pure geniuses. He invented the early prototype for the heart-lung machine while he was a medical student. And then as he got into it, he was in World War II. He basically developed the concept of MASH units during World War II, which became so critical for the Army during the Korean War. He started the veterans hospital system as we know it. Trust me, there weren't any problems like there are today back when he ran it, though.
I bet that's a big topic with Jacob.
And he invented the first Dacron patch surgery. His mom was a seamstress, and that was how he learned to sew. And he actually invented the very first graft for an artery. All of his work was, way ahead of everybody. He did the first bypass. He did the first carotid endarterectomy, where they take the fat out of the internal carotid artery. So the guy was one of these true geniuses, and it was almost to the point where he was too smart for his own good or for people around him. So when you go on his service, at the time, this is in the late 70s, you had heard the stories. He was called Black Mike. And if he was upset, if somebody screwed up, he would fire his entire resident staff on a Friday, and he would have a new resident staff come Monday.
Ah, how awful.
It was tough. So you go on his service, and it was pretty interesting because I figured out after a while that he really didn't know the difference between each resident every 3 months. And for him, the same resident kept making the same mistake every 3 months, and he just couldn't figure it out. So they figured out, the residency, they figured out, okay, what we need to do is we need to send DeBakey out of the city when the new residence starts so they can get their bearings. His secretary was named Sylvia. She probably worked for him for about 25 years, and then he ended up firing her. But Sylvia would take you, and she would say, okay, first thing you do every morning, 5:30, I don't care what you're doing, you come up to the office, and you make two pots of coffee. First pot is decaf, and you put it on the top. Second pot is regular coffee, and you put it on the bottom. And that's so when DeBakey comes in the morning, he automatically knows to grab the top coffee. It's decaf, so his hands don't shake during surgery. And she stressed, first thing you do every morning. The third morning, I was down there at 5:30. I came in. Coffee was already made. And at that point, I realized that that was DeBakey letting me know that he is always one step ahead of me.
Wow.
So he would, you know, you learn that you don't let the patient, he would have patients from around the world. He operated on the king of the gypsies, and he operated on kings and queens and the heads of the military. So one of the things every morning, you never let the patient's families kiss his hands. So you always had
That must have been a challenge.
Oh, it was, because, you know, the Romanians, the Italians, everybody from Europe, they want to kiss his hands for good luck. So you had to run interference for him on the way to the operating room. He was tough. He would demand perfection. He expected it. And he couldn't understand why you didn't deliver. To him, if you made a mistake, there were only two reasons. Either you were stupid or you didn't care. He would tolerate stupidity, but he never tolerated you didn't care. And he would, if you ever had a resident like that that screwed up, they were gone that afternoon. It was kind of an amazing situation.
Did you ever feel a personal connection with a man, or do you think he had any real connections with anybody?
Yeah, he did. And what happened was, in the afternoons, we would make rounds, and then we would come to his office, and he would sit down at at his desk, and he had a long desk with a view box in front. So your job as his resident was to open the chart, pull out the labs, and put the x-rays up, and give a little 30-second talk about who the patient is. DeBakey would look at everything. He would look at the x-rays, and then there was a group of about maybe 10 cardiologists. And so he would look at everything, and he would say, Dr. Attara, please take this patient. Or, you know, he would divvy it up. And we would be up there, and he would be going through this. And this was a time when he had just gotten married to a German actress. I think her name was Katrin, and they had a little girl. And so while I was there, his girl was two or three years old. We would be up there working, and she would show up with the little girl, and he would get up and leave and go play with her for about 15 or 20 minutes every afternoon. And that was one of those moments where, knowing how extreme he was, he would still get up and he would play with his little girl. And that was, to me, important. It was an important lesson that you can do everything, but there's got to be some family in there somewhere.
Right. Well, and, you know, from what I hear, maybe that's a lesson he learned from his first family that he didn't do quite so much with.
It's hard to say. I think we all, as we go through life and overcome whatever hardships there are, we have different goals and needs that we have to take care of.
Do you think he may have been slightly autistic?
No. He was just one of these guys that he had a million things going on. And he demanded perfection, and he expected it. He had a patient list. He had three secretaries. He had one secretary whose job was only to type up his patient list, which was about 15 typewritten pages.
Wow.
He had one secretary who only did the x-rays, and one secretary who only did the labs. And everybody kept it perfect, and that was the way he liked it.
Well, thank you for filling in some gaps, because everybody knows about Michael DeBakey, but there's so much about the guy that I don't want lost to history.
No, it won't be.
If you're joining us, you're listening to 90.1 KPFT, So What's Your Story? In Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 90.3 in Livingston. I'm your host, Greg Audell. And our guest tonight is doctor, lawyer, screenwriter, raconteur, director of the Legal Aid Program at Legacy Health Clinics, Stephen Wexler. And if you want to hear any of our previous shows, just log on to kpft.org/archives for our last six shows, or to houstonstorytellers.org for a more comprehensive archive of our shows. By listening to us, you are part of our story. And to keep these powerful storytelling moments coming into your home, your car, or wherever you listen, make your voice heard loudly and clearly that you want to keep the power of storytelling alive. Whether you're wherever you're listening to us from, you are part of our storytelling community, and we would appreciate any financial support. You can contribute online at kpft.org. Just click the Donate Now option. When you click on your selected payment method, you'll scroll to So What's Your Story and indicate the amount you wish to pledge. No contribution is too small, and none is too large. As long as we have community support, we will stay right here bringing you stories that intrigue, entertain, and hopefully sometimes bewilder you. At So What's Your Story, we're about spotlighting common folks with stories to tell. Neighbors, friends, who share their skills, experiences, and hearts every week, just as Stephen Wexler is doing tonight. And you know what? You've got your own story. And if you want help improving your public speaking, improving your ability to tell your story, I would urge you to come out to meet and hear other great storytellers from across Houston with our sponsor, the best storytelling group in the state, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild helps keep the art and the craft of storytelling alive and vibrant. Jacob, can you tell us when and where the Guild's going to meet next?
Yes, their monthly story swaps are on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m., located at the Printing Museum, which is at 1324 West Clay Street, right in the heart of Montrose. Check out all the events sponsored by the Guild and information about becoming a member at www.houstonstorytellers.org.
Next week, our host will be Warren Holloman, and his guest will be Carlos Garcia, founder of Cigar Nights for Vets. He'll tell us powerful stories of some of the challenges veterans have faced when transitioning back into civilian life. You know, it's something Jake's talked to us a lot about, and I look forward to hearing Carlos and Warren visit. You know, shortly after college, I ran the Houston Volunteer Lawyers Program under our director, Alice Wilson. And the number one question I often get from people when discussing that job is, why do low-income people need lawyers? Do you have a 30-second explanation that might help people understand why?
Everybody needs lawyers at some point. The problem for low-income is that they don't have access to either a lawyer or a way to get the knowledge that they need in order to figure out what has to be done. It's called the justice gap in the United States, where even people that are middle income can't afford a lawyer, and all of a sudden we have not enough lawyers, not enough people available to help, not enough money for all of the people who do need, seriously need some assistance.
I saw it on the front lines, and I think what you're doing is desperately needed, and I suspect it is desperately appreciated. And it is interesting to me how your career kind of careened from medicine to law, and it's landed you in this position to help people in a profound way. But I know the decision to stop practicing medicine wasn't necessarily one you would have chosen if you'd been given the opportunity at the time. Will you tell us your story about what led to that decision and why you didn't simply retire when given the opportunity?
The story, I would say, goes back to 1973, and I was on my way to medical school, and I went to see a movie called A Paper Chase, and I think it was at the Windsor Theater on Richmond. And it was one of those movies that, for whatever reason, spoke to me, especially the scene where Timothy Bottoms is in the classroom and Professor Kingsfield's calling on him and he can't answer, and he calls him to the front of the room and he says, "Mr. Hart, please, here's a dime. Go call your mother and tell her that there's serious doubt as to whether you'll ever be an attorney." And so Timothy Bottoms, takes the dime, he turns around, he's like walking in a daze, and he gets to the door and he turns around and he goes, "Kingsfield, you're an asshole," or something. He says something like that, and Kingsfield goes, Mr. Hart, that's the most intelligent thing you've said all day. Please take your seat. So I saw that, and to me at that point, my life has always been a looking for the Professor Kingsfield, looking for the challenge. So at that time, I thought, I'm looking for the challenge, the Professor Kingsfield. Little did I know that I'd be working with the real one when I was with DeBakey.
Well, it's interesting. I think that would turn a lot of people off to those careers. I think that speaks a lot about you, that it would motivate you.
Well, it was at the time. So, you know, I was a plastic surgeon for about 15 years, and then I'd started to have some neck problems. I had neck pain. I thought I was just working too hard. I couldn't button a collar on my collar, and I thought I was gaining weight. And then it was December 2000. I was doing a liposuction, and toward the end of the case, I couldn't hold the cannula, and I was dropping instruments. So it was one of those moments where,
wow.
For doctors, we always think the worst, but we're also the greatest deniers.
Yeah.
So I went to see my neurosurgeon. He checked me out. I had to go get an MRI and come back. He goes, I got good news and bad news. I said, what's the good news? He said, well, you've got a large tumor, but it's benign, because if it was malignant, you'd have been dead 2 years ago.
That was the good news.
That was my good news. I said, what's the bad news? He said, the bad news is you're going to need one, maybe two operations, and you'll probably never be able to do surgery again. So within about a three-week period, I had to close my practice completely.
Wow.
And, you know, it's one of those, you have no idea what's going to happen. I had surgery, and then as all doctors, that are patients, we all get complications. I had a complication, and at that time, after that surgery, I was in a wheelchair for about a month, and you really don't know for sure if you're going to be able to walk again. Slowly, it kind of came back, and then I had to use a walker for about 6 months, and then there's that statement that people say that only when you have nothing can you be truly free, and all of a sudden, that was where I was living. I'd always wanted to be a screenwriter. I used to go to Sundance every year. I called up my friends from Sundance. They said, well, come on out. So I went out to Hollywood. Spent about 6 months out there working, doing some things with screenwriting, but I wasn't really moving. I wasn't willing to move out there. Came back to Houston. I knew Sam Havens, who was the head of the drama department at St. Thomas.
You know
really
what?
Well.
I bartended at Sam Haven and Gretchen's wedding.
What a great guy. He saw me on my walker. He said, Steve, what's going on? I gave him the story. He said, why don't you come take some classes? So here I am. I'm 50 years old. And I said, okay. So I go and I'm getting my master's in theater at St. Thomas, and it was great. It was one of those experiences that you think to yourself, I can't believe how much I love this. So I decided I was enjoying going back to college. I finished, got my master's, and I said, I'm going to get my MBA. So I went and got my MBA, and then the moment of truth was in the back of my mind. Here I am. I'm going to go to law school. And I had said it in 1973, but I never really thought I would. So I went to South Texas, and for me, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. It was a matter of just getting in there, and what was interesting was that most of the law school professors are dying for conversation. The problem is that the great majority of kids come out of college, go to law school, have no idea how to talk, and they're afraid to talk. So what they do is, they actually hide behind their laptops. Me, I was front row, every class. Yeah. I never raised my hand, just start talking. And it was really one of those experiences of being a part of this didactic knowledge that goes back hundreds of years.
Was there ever a point that you thought you might do what a lot of people do and simply retire from life?
Yeah, there was. And it's not so much retiring from life. It's more a question of depression and leave and getting, you know, hiding. And right after everything had happened with my surgery, I probably had about a month or 2 month severe depression. And it was one of those moments of you wake up in the morning, you look at yourself in the mirror and slap a couple of times. You said, this is it. I'm getting out of here and I'm going to do it. And And look, fortunately, I did.
I think that serves as a lesson to all of us, because we all get knocked down by life's unexpected curveballs. And, you know, maybe not as much as having our life and career threatened and having to shift gears as you did. But, you know, I'm going to try and remember that the next time I'm feeling sorry for myself.
I'd grown up and I was a black belt in Taekwondo, and I had my own school. And that was one of the more important things in my life that forced me to, all right, I'm going to do this. And I did. And then it's really, you know, as we face death or these disasters in our lives, you understand you have one day at a time. Yeah. You don't have next week. You don't have next month. You have today. And you have to live like that, and you've got to make the best out of every day.
Well, I will say, I've always noted that when I'm in a conversation with you, you are more present in that moment than most people I know.
We have to be. And the good lawyers are, too.
You know, another thing I love about Stephen is that I hope he doesn't mind me bringing up, but I love it when he talks about his sons, because I know Stephen quite well, but I can never keep straight which son's a biological son and which son is a stepson. And I think it's because I've always gotten the impression that he doesn't really pay much attention to that. I think each of them know that he is the go-to guy 24/7. That's actually more impressive to me than all the degrees anyone could acquire. What's your favorite thing about fatherhood?
It's always different. I got three boys. Every one of the boys. And I think that I'm fortunate because they have good support systems within their lives also. But I think that it's just a matter of luck. I think you have to lead by example. And once they see you doing it and that you love what you're doing, I do think it rubs off. Not always. And there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of luck involved. But I've got my oldest is an attorney here in Houston. My middle one was a musician for several years, and he's going to law school. And the youngest, who's going to be 18, God, I can't believe that, is a cyber defense, cybersecurity expert, and that's what he wants to do. And I just love watching the mind work.
I think you'd agree that biology has very little to do with being a dad.
Right. No, it's not.
You know, it's funny. The circumstances are different, but your story, you know, about deciding basically to be a good father makes me think of an interview I did with Ray Charles when I was 12 years old, and I was at a press conference, and this reporter next to me said, you know, Mr. Charles, you know, you've got a lot of illegitimate children. You've been pretty public about that. Can you tell us how many illegitimate children do you have? And Ray Charles turned, and he said, you know, of all the questions I've ever been asked, that is the dumbest. He said, I don't know what an illegitimate child is. Can you tell me? He goes, you know, I got however many kids he had. He said, some of them I was married to their mamas. Some of them I wasn't. But they are all my children. Right. And, man, I loved Ray Charles after that. So we're going to close tonight's show with Ray Charles singing one of his lesser-known hits, You Are My Sunshine. This life is short, my friends. A few weeks ago, Houston lost one of our unique and insightful observers and photographers with the unexpected passing of Andrew Redman. If you don't know his work, get online and discover it. Please reach out to people in your world who need a shoulder to cry on, an ear to listen to with some kindness, or maybe something more significant when they're going through hard times. The power to help is an awesome power, and for the most part, it expires when we do. If you can make a difference to someone through a small act or large, do it. And if you want to share your story of what you've done with us, go to our Facebook page, So What's Your Story? And tell us. I guarantee you'll be glad you did. If you want to tell us about it, post it on the So What's Your Story Facebook page or send it in to kpft.org with your contribution. Scooter's next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour at KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just taking a break from the weight of the day, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And we'll help you ease into the weekend right. Keep loving a good story, and with your support and your contributions and your submissions to our Facebook page, we'll keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other, Till we meet again, I'm Greg Audell, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after.
KPFT is in the final days of its month-long birthday celebration, and many listeners just like you have given first-time donations.